As the Winter Olympic Games in Sochi approach, the eyes of the world are on Russia. What should we know about our former Cold War foe today? Over the past year, there has been so much news out of Russia, it's hard to keep up. In June, Russia began a crackdown on gay rights by passing a law against so-called gay propaganda. In September, Russian President Vladimir Putin stepped in to avert a possible U.S. strike on Syrian chemical weapon sites and brokered a deal to destroy Syria's chemical weapons stockpile. In November, Putin released oil tycoon and Kremlin critic Mikhail Khodorkovsky from prison. And then last month released members of the punk band Pussy Riot from jail. They'd been arrested after staging an anti-Putin concert in a church. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we turn to several experts to put all of this into context. Maine Calling asks, what from the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is less than 2 days from the opening ceremonies at the Sochi Winter Olympic Games. The world will be watching to see how and if Vladimir Putin has managed to pull off an event that's been years in the making, costs a record $50 billion, and takes place under intense security and fear of a terrorist attack. Russia today is a country of great contrast. The days of the Soviet Empire may be gone, but Putin's reign has some drawing parallels to it. Today, we have a panel of experts to help us understand Russia a little better. With me in the studio, Laura Henry, who's acting chair of the Russian department at Bowdoin College. Suzanne Massey, a lifelong student of Russia and author of Trust But Verify, Reagan, Russia, and Me, which was just released. In our Bangor studio, James Warhola, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Maine in Orono, and on the line from his office in Washington, D.C., Kyle Parker. He's senior policy advisor for Russia at the U.S. Helsinki Commission and a native of Old Town and a graduate of the University of Maine. Of course, we want to hear from you on this snowy day. What do you think of U.S.-Russian relations? What do you want to know about Russia? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And thank you all for joining us today. I have a feeling 1 hour is not going to be enough for this topic. And Laura Henry, I'll start with you. How important is this having the international spotlight on Russia, the Olympic Games spotlight for Vladimir Putin and for Russia?
Well, first of all, Jennifer, thank you so much for having us here today. It's a great panel. And I should say, even though I'm the chair of the Russian department at Bowdoin, I'm also a political scientist. So I think a lot about Vladimir Putin. And Putin went after these games very carefully in 2007 in Guatemala. He learned his proposal in English and in French. He really wanted to show that Russia was once again one of the world's great powers, capable of putting on a truly global event and bring Russia back into the spotlight. And for that reason, these games have often been called Putin's games. In a sense, they are a way of legitimizing his return to the presidency in 2012 and the possibility that he could remain in office as president until 2024, quite a long time. You know, in that sense, a lot is riding on these games. Russia's economic growth has slowed. Russia is increasingly dependent on the price of oil in order to buoy up its budget. And Putin is seeking other kinds of legitimacy. Return to traditional values is one kind of legitimacy. And also successful games would be a big boon to his presidency. Of course, the journalistic coverage in the lead up to the games has been quite critical, especially from the foreign press. So a lot is riding on whether or not at the end of these 2 or 3 weeks, we're still talking about corruption and gay rights, or we're talking about amazing opening ceremonies and successful Olympic events.
Jim Arhola, are you concerned about security? There's been so much in the news about whether there'll be a terrorist attack at these games. And why or why not would you be concerned about security?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for including me in this on this panel in your program, and much appreciated. And To your question, yes, there is, you know, cause for concern. It seems to me that the Putin administration has done just about everything humanly possible to ramp up security as high as it could humanly be. There are about 340,000 residents in the city of Sochi, and there are about 100,000 security personnel in there. The measures that the Putin administration has taken to secure the Olympics are, I don't think extreme, frankly, is too strong of a word. On the other hand, there is good reason for concern. The whole Caucasus region area of southwestern Russia has been in a state of insurgency to varying degrees ever since the collapse of the USSR. It's been a particularly restive region within – it was within the Russian Empire going back to the late 1700s when the Tsarist forces went into that region of the world and annexed it to the Russian Empire. And in fact, as of – just to kind of put things in perspective, in – according to one website called Kavkazsky Uzil, the Caucasian Knot, it's a Russian website, but it's sort of sympathetic to the insurgents. According to them, 968 people were killed in the North Caucasus region last year. People of various sorts, some Russian security people, some civilians, some insurgents, and it's a it's a dangerous place. And even though Sochi is part of the Russian administrative district called Krasnodar, it's the traditional homeland of the Circassian people who were brought under Russian control in the late 1700s. And again, there's just a tangled web of insurgency there. And I'm sure some of the details of that we'll talk about in the course of the program. But the short of it is that those insurgency groups, and again, they're a multiplicity of such groups, but kind of the umbrella organization is called the Caucasus Emirate under the leadership, I suppose one could say, of a fellow by the name of Doku Umarov, who's predominantly Chechen. He's got some other ethnicity mixed in as well, but he's predominantly Chechen, at least from all the evidence available.
Well, let's bring Kyle Parker into the conversation at this point, because Kyle, mm-hmm. this is a big part of what you study, correct? The Chechen threat. Remind us, who exactly are the Chechen rebels? Does the U.S. view them as terrorists? And what is the status of their fight? Kyle Parker?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. The U.S. Does now view some of them as foreign terrorists and subject them to, you know, formal designation and sanctions that we have available against such groups. That was a long struggle, I think, on the part of, you know, the Russian government certainly had spent a lot of time, particularly post 9/11, to convince the United States that, in fact, they face a terrorist threat in the South, not unlike some of the terrorist threat we have faced. What are they? I think you mentioned the Chechen resistance. I don't know that that is as accurate a term now as it might have been some years ago, in the throes of the first and second Chechen wars. You now have sort of a trans-Caucasian, if you will, certainly in the northern Caucasus, which is, you know, entirely inside of Russia proper. And the new flashpoint has migrated over to Dagestan, where a lot of these groups have strongholds and bases. And it's a very different makeup than what we saw in Chechnya. Chechnya largely, homogeneous, and Dagestan is really an ethnic soup. So it sort of almost ensures, you know, simmering low intensity conflict as opposed to the specter of separatism, which is what was talked about during the Chechen wars.
Mm. Suzanne Massey, you have been intimately involved with the Russian people for more than half a century as an author and scholar and as an emissary during the Reagan years. What do you want our listeners to know, to understand about the Russian people today? What are misperceptions that you hear back here in the United States?
Well, thank you, Jennifer, and thank you for including me with these distinguished political science historians. I am very grateful. I always call myself a student because the real meaning of that word is that one is continuing to learn. And I am really trying to learn right now. I cannot possibly tell you what all the Russians are doing, but I do know a little bit about the cultural things that are strong, I think. I've been a cultural historian, as my book, Firebird, Land of the Firebird, and Pavlovsk. So I've been very interested in this subject. And first of all, I've often said that Russia is a woman, and that explains her, her capriciousness and her unpredictability and her sensitivity and her fertility, that she takes new ideas and transforms them in some way, as they did with Marxist-Leninism and as they did with ballet. Well, they're in the process of transforming and in a transition, I think. I think Putin, of course, is a product of Soviet life, Soviet training, and therefore we recognize that in him. But nevertheless, he, as millions of his subjects, are trying to learn how to live in a non-Soviet world. Now, right now, I think that whether they say it or whether they don't say it, stability is one of the most important things for Russians. Remember, they had 27 years of war in the 20th century, and right now they've been in periods of chaos. And how many times have I heard them say, all we want is to be a normalnaya strana, a normal country. So I put that. But also important to know now is that it's a country of young people, which we don't often think, but it's tragically a country of young people because so many of the old died and were dispensed with, and I would say a whole generation of males, for instance, which is very important. And, of course, this new generations have different aspirations, and they are now, we're coming into one which will have had no Soviet education whatsoever. So it's very interesting. I know many. I have godchildren there. So I would think their new aspirations are also linked to the new possibilities. Travel, for one thing. Much better accommodations for this young middle class that's going. The children of my translators are very good examples, but I won't go into them. But they are now, you know, decorating their own apartments and doing lots of things. I mean, in other words, Russia is changing. What is it changing into? I think they themselves are not sure of. They go backwards. They do things that we highly disapprove of. But on the other hand, they also are doing other things. And the single most important thing for me is that religion has become very strong. Two-thirds, after all those years of persecution of religion, now, 20 years later, the country is now calls itself Orthodox, two-thirds of the country. And they are now been stated that they are the people who believe in God more than any other country in Europe. To me, historically, this is very interesting, a kind of tectonic shift. But the young people are particularly, that I know, they're particularly interested in that. And, of course, now there's Baptist, everything is in church. I would say, I'm not a political scientist, but I personally think that the two most important men in Russia now or the patriarch and his right hand, who is educated at Oxford and writes magnificent religious music.
Now, and that's so interesting that that most of, there's an entire generation that's grown up in the post-Soviet world, probably anybody under 25 now or 30, if I'm doing my math right, and also that they are more religious than they are today. You brought up church, and Laura, I wanted to ask you about Pussy Riot, and it's sort of ironic they're young, and they were arrested for performing in a church against Vladimir Putin's policy. So that's an interesting connection there. Right now, Pussy Riot's in the news. They're in New York City to give a concert connected with Amnesty International. What does the arrest and then subsequent release of Pussy Riot band members signal about social protest in Russia today?
Well, I hope that Kyle will weigh in on this as well. But as Putin and his regime have become increasingly authoritarian, especially upon his return to the presidency, I think that the opposition is struggling for different ways to express their desire for some liberalization of politics, some change in politics. Pussy Riot is certainly an unusual group, a group they don't consider themselves really a punk rock band, even though that's how they're portrayed in the West. They're more of an artist collective. And when they performed at the Church of the Savior in Moscow, they were singing a song called Putin's Prayer, which was an anti-Putin song about how he had led the country off track. Their arrest was technically they were arrested for violating laws of blasphemy because they were performing in a church. And that did signal part of Putin's return to the idea of traditional values, of orthodoxy, of family, of particular standards of behavior, that he sort of working with the church to kind of construct the basis for his new regime. But I think what's even more interesting is the fact that they were released under this recent amnesty. In addition to the activists from the Greenpeace Arctic Sunrise who had been arrested protesting oil drilling in the Arctic Sea, and also Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who had been in prison for almost a decade, the oligarch, the former owner of Yukos Oil Company, who was arrested on tax evasion charges but widely thought to have been arrested because he was funding a think tank and other kind of political activity that called into question the presidential regime that Vladimir Putin had constructed. I think this is all part of a sign that Putin didn't want attention on these particular issues during the Olympics themselves. I'm not sure that it signals anything about a broader or longer thaw. In fact, I listen a lot to kind of more pro-democratic news from Russia, and those individuals are expecting a crackdown after the Olympics once the international spotlight shifts.
All right. Well, we have to take a quick break, and Kyle, I do want to get you to weigh in on this idea of where social protest is in Russia today. When we come back, also your comments and questions. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Techport, offering iPad repair and return service statewide by mail. Mac certified and locally owned. Learn more at techportmaine.com. By Silly's in Portland's East End. Open at 11 Tuesday through Friday and at 9 for brunch on the weekends with vegan and gluten-free options. Silly's.com. And by Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston, whose winter brew, Phantom Punch Winter Stout, is available now. Learn more at BaxterBrewing.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the Next On Point, American community colleges say they're on the front line of holding together an unraveling society. We'll get the message. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join us for On Point tonight at 11 o'clock here on MPBN.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, U.S.-Russia relations on the eve of the Sochi Winter Olympic Games. With me in the studio, Laura Henry, acting chair of the Russian Department at Bowdoin College and a political scientist. Suzanne Massey, the author of several books, including her recent Trust But Verify, Reagan, Russia, and Me. In our Bangor studio, James Warhola, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Maine, and on the line from his office in Washington, Kyle Parker. He's senior policy advisor for Russia at the U.S. Helsinki Commission and a native of Old Town. We would like you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Kyle, before we went to a break, we were talking about social protest in Russia today, one of your areas of study, I understand. What is your take on the recent release of Pussy Riot, Khodorkovsky, and the others that Laura mentioned?
Well, I would agree with Laura in that I don't think it signals a systemic any systemic reform or change. And you know, in a sense, it may be as simple as an authoritarian leader like Vladimir Putin gives, an authoritarian leader like Vladimir Putin takes away, simply because he can. This type of a move is destabilizing and confusing to the narrative, and that certainly may be useful heading into the Sochi Olympics. But even as we see that, we've seen a tightening of the screws, certainly in the Sochi region, on free media. We've seen, some frankly frightening legislative proposals that may be on the horizon. One of the most serious attempts to rein in internet freedom the internet in Russia is generally free, and certainly while TV is controlled across the country, the populations of Moscow and St. Petersburg have access on the internet to alternative news and information. I would also mention that, you know, Russia's at a really dynamic time right now. It's quite exciting and, you know, and also potentially concerning, but things are changing. You know, this is not the Russia that won the Olympic bid in 2007. So much has happened since then, politically and economically. This is also not the Russia that arrested Pussy Riot in the lead up to Putin's inauguration and election, his return to the return to power. So it's changing. As Suzanne Massey mentioned, the religious sentiment in Russia, I would simply note that, you know, in Russia, that I think that is felt in a different way and measured and understood in a different way than we might understand it here, a less moralistic sort of behavioral way and more cultural, more intertwined with culture and national identity. On social protests specifically, I would just bring in the events in Ukraine and put them out there, not as a diversion, but as something that is being watched very closely by a dispirited Russian opposition that had tried in 2011 to muster similar street protests, and then they ran out of steam and sort of faded in the face of a crackdown in Russia, whereas the Ukraine protests have grown stronger. If anything triggers a crackdown in Russia post-Sochi, the events in Ukraine may very well be that trigger.
Mm. Jim Orhola, also in the headlines, the U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, just announced his resignation yesterday. He says he will leave Russia after the Olympic Games. Why do you think he's resigning, and what is the significance of his resignation?
Well, those are not there's no easy, straightforward answer to those questions. He's been in a very, very difficult position when he, of course, was an academic, not a career foreign service officer. He authored a number of books on Russia, and some of his other academic work dealt with transitions away from authoritarian regimes and towards more democratic regimes. He was appointed ambassador to Russia at a time when the Putin administration, 3 years ago, at a time when the Putin administration was, of course, very, very concerned about something like the so-called color revolutions, migrating into Russia the way they had in Ukraine in 2004 and Georgia 2003 and Kyrgyzstan 2005. And the point is that just about the last thing the Putin administration wanted was to hear much of anything from a U.S. ambassador about Russia's deficit of democracy and creating the conditions for a more a transition to a more democratic regime. The official line of the Putin administration was that Russia's got its own form of democracy called sovereign democracy. Thank you very much. We don't need any sermons or advice from the United States. And, Ambassador McFaul was, I think he did a terrific job, but he was in a very, very difficult position. Who might follow him? It's hard to say. My sense and just from what I'm reading coming out of Washington is that, they may go back to, someone more like a long-term career foreign service officer like former Ambassador Collins or Pickering and so on. Mm. If I may, just very quickly throw in a word or two about the religion question and the back to the issue of the security in the Olympics and so on. I completely agree with everything that was said. First of all, Laura's comments about and Kyle seconding the comments about, the release of these previously detained or jailed individuals, that not being sort of emblematic of some sort of systemic change in Russia. Totally agree. In fact, Russia has a long, long history going back to Ivan the IV in the middle of the 16th century, otherwise known as Ivan Grozny or Ivan the Terrible. Just kind of episodically releasing political prisoners. They've done this. They even did that back in the days of the USSR, for goodness sakes. So, this isn't, signal any systemic change per se, the fact they let Khodorkovsky out of jail or Pussy Riot or anybody else. I don't think it's a bad thing, but I think one should not read too much into it. Under the religion, just very, very quickly, Suzanne is absolutely right that after the collapse of the USSR, there was this dramatic increase in interest in religion and uptick in religiosity in just about every measurable dimension. Some of it has remained. Other parts of it, as Kyle intimated, have just kind of reflected a ongoing cultural interest with things religious. One thing I think it might be that might be a useful insight for our listeners to bear in mind is that this dramatic increase in interest in religion and in some respects increase in practicing religiosity has manifested itself in the fact that, among other things, that this insurgency in the Caucasus region, including the Sochi area, the Olympics, that this insurgency during the 1990s essentially morphed from an independence movement from Chechnya into an increasingly religiously oriented conflict. And so much of the threat that against which the Russia or the Putin regime is reacting and trying to deal with in the Sochi Olympics, so much of that threat or at least it frames itself in terms of a religiously based resistance to the Putin regime. I don't think it's an accident. Just one more comment on this, and then I'll be quiet here. But I don't think it was an accident that this Doku Umarov, the head of this Caucasus Emirate, the one that vowed that they were going to disrupt the Olympics. They did this so last June. And what he said was that, the Russians came in, took our territory, and that we are not going to allow the Russians to stage the Olympics on the bones of our ancestors. And that's almost a verbatim quotation of what Umarov said. So I don't think the Putin administration is to be faulted for taking just extraordinary security measures to ensure the safety of the
and he was killed, right?
Olympics. No.
No, it was another leader who was killed. Okay, I'm sorry.
The leader of Chechnya, a guy by the name of Ramzan Kadyrov, claims that Umarov has been killed, but it's not been definitively confirmed or disconfirmed.
Okay. Suzanne, I want to ask you sort of a broad question. You served as emissary for President Reagan when he was negotiating with Mikhail Gorbachev. Do you see any parallels between then and now in U.S.-Russia relations, or is it entirely different?
Well, I'm very sorry to say I just came back from Washington and heard a great many Washington, if I may say, experts or students. And they all said that relations are more toxic now than they have been even when, and I quote, before when we were trying to annihilate each other. And I tried to find a reason why. But they're very different. President Reagan, of course, as all of you probably know, had a wonderful personality. He was interested in people above all things. He was interested in what did the Russian people think, not what did the Kremlin think. We had made that into a synonym here. We used Russian and Soviet as a synonym. One Russian once said to me, why is it always a Soviet Sputnik in Russian tank? That explains it. Now, Reagan really wasn't getting that, and he wanted to find that out. And I'd spent a good long time in what I called my worm's eye view, which was on the street, because I was doing all this work in various historic places. And so now it's very different. I think the personalities of, let us say, President Obama and Putin somehow are not, you know, as the French would say, the atoms are not hooking together one way or another. President Obama is much more closed individual than President Reagan. Reagan did really go against his advisors to try to see Gorbachev, etc. And he did a wonderful job in it. He also did a great deal, this I know personally, to learn about Russian culture, Russian history, which is extremely important. And one of the things that struck me is that recently I was told by someone, actually, that I was seeing at a church thing up in Maine, up in Deer Island, and he had a great friend who was a reporter who had asked Gorbachev what was the most important thing that made him feel that he could deal with Ronald Reagan. And Gorbachev answered that it was when he used that Russian proverb, trust but verify. Now, I think to me that shows a great deal about kind of Russian thinking in its way. And, you know, I think Obama is very, very cerebral. At least he strikes me that way. I've never met him. But Putin, whom I have met and do know, is much more emotional than we give him credit for. He is not a man who eats babies. He is not a man. I saw him at the funeral of his mentor, Anatoly Sobchak, actually sobbing. I mean, he was quite openly, and he said, what will I ever do without him? And Anatoly Sobchak was, of course, the first democratically elected mayor of St. Petersburg. So I think he's a very complicated person. I think he's in a very complicated situation. I think that that we haven't shown much, I may say, interest in that or even sympathy for that. I think we forget that Putin was the first world leader to call President Bush to, after 9/11, to offer Russian help and in any way. We forget that. We forget that Putin has also helped us sometimes in getting things to Afghanistan, doing a lot. But that's why I don't know. I've always felt that, you know, Russians are often trying to impress us as if they're the woman, we're the man. And we're not very good at responding to that, trying to impress us. So I see that these two, I mean, Reagan, of course, was so affable, so charming, that even people who disagreed with him completely always said they didn't know why, but he was so nice. Now, Obama has been criticized for exactly the opposite, for not coming out, and not just with the Russians, but that he's a much more closed person. And I have a feeling that that has a lot to do with it. I can't see the two of them finding, let's say, just a common human ground, you know? I mean, and the Russians are awfully human with all their bad qualities and all their good ones, but they seem to have them in excess, both sides. But that's what I, in a word, I would say, no, it's very different, and it has not been successful, and I am very sorry that at this time, which should be, we have never had more Russians living here, coming here, studying here, even marrying here. That was impossible in those Soviet years. Now we have that, and yet here we are with very, if I use that word again, toxic relations. And I really tried to find out from the Washingtonians why they thought it was, and nobody could explain it. And our media is, I think, really so bad, always reporting the negative, never reporting the positive. But I don't know why it is. I really don't. Mm. And I'm sorry for that, because as one of these Washingtonians said to me, we are missing a lot of opportunities.
So on that note, we're going to have to go to a break. But I promise Chris and Pamela, we will get to your calls after we come back. We'll be right back. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Revision Energy, a local business specializing in the design, installation, and service of solar energy systems. RevisionEnergy.com. Every day you hear messages about local businesses and organizations that provide their financial support to MPBN. They all understand the value of MPBN in our community and have decided to make public radio and television a part of their marketing effort. If you would like to learn what these folks already know, please visit mpbn.net and click on Business Support. There you'll find information about the value of sponsorship and answers to frequently asked questions. Or you can just give us a call at 1-800-884-1717. Ask for Susan Tran. And as always, thank you for your support of public broadcasting in Maine. Coming up on our 1 o'clock Public Affairs Hour today, a rebroadcast of last night's 2014 State of the State address by Governor Paul LePage and reaction by the legislature's Democratic leadership, right here on MPBN.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're discussing Russia. With me in the studio, Laura Henry, who is acting chair of the Russian Department at Bowdoin College. Suzanne Massey, author of Trust But Verify, Reagan, Russia, and Me. In our Bangor studio, James Warhala, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Maine in Orono. And on the line from his office in Washington, D.C., Kyle Parker, senior policy advisor for Russia at the U.S. Helsinki Commission. We'd like you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Laura, before the break, we were talking about perceptions of Vladimir Putin. And you agreed with Suzanne that the way the U.S. views him is maybe not quite
accurate.
Well, I did want to expand on a good point that I thought that Suzanne made about kind of oversimplifying Vladimir Putin and sort of seeing him as a classic tin pot dictator. And how could he ever, how can the Russians tolerate having him govern their country? I do think that the media coverage can get to be quite one-sided. And Putin consistently has a popularity rating above 60%. Now, it's not the 85% it used to be, but it's above 60%. And I do think it's important for Americans to understand that Russia's experience in the immediate aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union was devastating. It was dislocating. People lost their life savings. They often lost their job. They lost their ability to plan for the future. And it was a period of high crime, instability, alcoholism, violence. And really, Putin pulled them out of the 1990s. Now, you could argue he got lucky. He came into office right as the economy was recovering, right as the price of oil was going up. He was able to use those things to benefit people. But under Putin, we've seen the emergence of stability, of a kind of a proto-middle class, a growing middle class, and a growing economy. And so we do need to understand that there is a real foundation for Putin's leadership of Russia.
Okay, as promised, going to the calls now. Chris in East Machias, thank you so much for waiting for us to take your call. What's your question?
Yes, thank you very, very much for taking my call. And my question is mainly to Suzanne, but to anyone on the panel like to answer it. When I was a young man, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago came out. I read all three volumes, as well as One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. I also remember that he decried what he saw as the immorality of the Western world. And my question is, what do you think he would say about the Russia of 2014? Thank you.
Well, that's a wonderful question. I wonder myself. I had the pleasure of having a letter from him about Land of the Firebird, and I knew his family. And he was pretty harsh on the United States, I will admit that. And, well, not even that. It's when he gave that speech at Harvard. And he was, well, criticized and isolated because he dared to criticize the United States. I think this question of immorality today, I think Russia is working toward a better moral position. Now, when I say that, I remember that Anatoly Sobchak and the patriarch, Alexei, when the 90s happened, said, both of them, that the greatest trouble of Russia was not economics, but morality. And, of course, we thought that business would solve things, and instead we got the oligarchs. So today I think there's a real, well, let us say, effort among the younger middle class, upward mobile, in fact, the ordinary people as well, to try to somehow find their way back to, I will say, a Christian morality, because the orthodoxy, and to find their way back. Now, it does have a cultural aspect. It does. There's no question about it. Orthodoxy is their identity. But I think it is much more, because I've heard this a great deal from young Russians about how important it is for them now to have their children be raised with some moral values. For that, they're talking about Christian moral values. Before, it was terrible. Their children were encouraged to lie. It was very hard for young couples to raise children in the Soviet, to raise, let's say, children with moral values in the Soviet period. So I think you're right. I'm not saying right, but I think it's a very important question.
Thank you, Chris, for your call. Going now to Pamela in Portland. Hi, Pamela. Go ahead.
Hello. I have two points. The first one, as I said to the phone person, is I'd like to know what the panel thinks about Edward Snowden's situation and his being given shelter by the Russian government and how long they think he will be there. And I also have a comment that I'm sure all your panel already knows, but perhaps your listeners don't, and that is that the Sochi Olympics have actually been built on ground sacred to the Circassian tribes who live in that area. It's called the Caucasus, but it is very, very tribal, and these are very, very devout Muslims. And nobody has used the word Muslim so far, but they go back to before the Crimean War, and there's always been tension there. So I'd like to hear a response to both the fact that the Olympic structures are built on holy ground, to the Circassians, who feel that they were slaughtered like the Armenians by the Russians, and also about Edward Snowden.
Edward Snowden. Kyle Parker, would you like to address Pamela's concerns and questions?
I could speak to the Edward Snowden question, and I guess I would just mention that I think, first of all, as to how long Snowden will be in Russia, I think that's really anyone's guess. There was some time a few months ago where people were thinking that somehow a solution might be arranged where he would transit to a third country and sort of remove an irritant with a big country like Russia and place an irritant in a smaller, perhaps South American country. Although recent comments from the Russians sort of saying that he's welcome to stay as long as he likes, perhaps we won't see an immediate sort of movement, at least him leaving Russia. As to what it meant for U.S.-Russian relations, I was frankly a little surprised that Snowden's sort of asylum seeking in Russia ended up being the straw that broke the camel's back, as it were. There were plenty of reasons leading up to this, including Russia's support for Bashar Assad in Syria, Russia's human rights record, a number of other things that were serious irritants, and all of a sudden Snowden shows up in the Moscow airport and everybody's hopping mad. I also would say that it's really not that surprising how the story played out. You show up in Moscow or Beijing with a laptop and secrets. For the United States to expect that somehow you would be placed on a flight and return, to me is, well, it's a little strange. It sort of seems like that's kind of how the game is played, and it's how it's been played. And so, again, I think that holds whatever you think of Snowden or his motives or the impact of his revelations. As to the Circassians,
go ahead.
I think I would leave that one to Professor Warhola, who I know has done some serious thinking on that.
And that's what I was about to do. Go ahead, Professor Warhola.
Okay, good. Excellent question. And as I mentioned that just a few minutes ago that, the leader of this Caucasus Emirate, this Doku Umarov, had said that, they're not going to allow these Olympics to go unchallenged. The Olympics being staged, quote, as he put it, on the bones of their ancestors. So that is the Circassian people and particularly the religious dimension that Pamela mentioned. And, the fact of the matter is that, as I mentioned, this insurgency that Russia has faced in the North Caucasus ever since the collapse, very shortly after the collapse of the USSR, that as the 1990s went on, it morphed into a religious conflict, at least as far as the insurgents were concerned. I think it was in 1997, in between the first and second Chechen wars, that they declared Chechnya to be an Islamic Republic. And as the Putin administration attempted to squash the reignition of that conflict in late summer and fall of 1999, which is one of the reasons, incidentally, that Putin was appointed prime minister and then on January 1 of 2000 was appointed acting president. What happened is that insurgency spread, and it once again it became an increasingly kind of a jihadist, or the conflict was phrased or framed in jihadist terms. And as Kyle correctly noted a little bit earlier, it no longer was just a Chechen versus Russian conflict, but rather it was phrased in terms of an Islamic emirate needing to be established in these lands that had been unjustly occupied by Russia for several hundred years now. And as the caller, Pamela, correctly noted, that Sochi was the traditional sort of capital or homeland or the epicenter, we might say, of that Circassian identity.
Jim, why then did Putin pick Sochi? Is it because it's a ski resort area, or was he making a statement by putting the Olympics there?
Okay, good question. Even during the Soviet times, Sochi was presented as kind of the Fort Lauderdale of the USSR, if you will. In fact, I just the other day saw an old Soviet film. It's about 14-15 minutes long, presenting, and it was made in 1978, I believe. And it was designed for consumption within the USSR to encourage people to go to Sochi for their vacation. It was presented as
so it's a beautiful place.
Soviet resort. Well, yeah, it's sort of, you know, not exactly tropical, but sort of tropical. I mean, there are palm trees there and so on. It's a lovely place right on the Black Sea. And I guess, you know, to answer your question as you know, cogently as possible, and again, there's no simple answer to it, but to move towards some sort of cogency for an answer to your question, as far as the Soviet regime was concerned, Sochi was it was sort of like the Fort Lauderdale of the former USSR. And that to some degree has carried over. How much has carried over into, you know, post-Soviet Russia is arguable. But it's still viewed as kind of like the Hawaii or the Fort Lauderdale,
okay,
what they are to the U.S. And yeah, and Putin himself, one of his favored vacation places is that Krasnaya Poligarya, the ski mountain area there where so much of the Olympics was being held. So I think he had kind of a personal soft spot for the place. But it also was just sort of emblematic of the U.S., you know, the United States. And there was a certain amount of invidiousness in this as well, I think. You know, the United States has got Hawaii and Miami and Fort Lauderdale, and we've got this, Sochi area.
So, okay. Well, Pamela, thank you for your good question. Suzanne Massey.
I just couldn't help thinking about this Circassian. Now, I'm not a specialist on this question. I do not question the fact that it could be, that it is a very tragic thing. But I am curious about the fact that we in the West have never questioned once how the Canadians got Calgary or how, in fact, we got Salt Lake City and from whom and on whose bones those places were built. So I don't know, and I can't compare, but I can't help but thinking that. It's obviously, I mean, countries conquer one way or another, but right. I just think of that as something strange.
I see your point, and I also find it interesting that when we talk about, and I say we collectively as people in the United States talk about Russia, we talk about, well, it's in their history. This is what they've always done, and this is what's in their culture. But we would be offended if people said that about us. Well, slavery is in our culture and in our history, and it's just how Americans think or something like that. But, Laura, very briefly, because I want to get to one more thing. Go ahead.
Suzanne's very, very good point. I read a statistic a few years ago. I don't know if it's true or not, but that something like between 60% and 65% of the illegal aliens in the United States from Mexico, when queried about the matter, said as far as they were concerned, the southwestern quadrant of the United States should still be part of Mexico since we stole it from in the Mexican-American War of 1848.
Right. So, point well made.
I
want to circle back, though, in the very beginning of this conversation, and we're almost out of time. Laura, you said that you believe that one of the reasons Putin wanted to have, and I'm probably going to paraphrase you wrong here, but one of the reasons Russia really wanted to have the Olympics, it was as a signal of Russia's return as a world power, which makes me ask, is Russia indeed the world power that it was?
Well, I mean, that's a challenging question. Russia will never be the world power that it was because the world is not the same place that it was. We're not locked in a bipolar Cold War of two states that have, you know, the power to annihilate each other. And that's the major cleavage in global politics. In fact, you know, we're living either in a unipolar or a multipolar world, depending on how you look at it. But Russia does think that it has a historic right to a particular sphere of influence, whether that sphere is political, whether it's linguistic and cultural or based on trade. And it does feel that this period of weakness, these decades of weakness that it's gone through, it's been taken advantage of by the United States, by the Europeans. It constantly worries that it could be taken advantage of by the Chinese and by others. And so Russia really has a very defensive mentality. And I've read things in Russian papers that this kind of barrage of foreign criticism about human rights and gay rights and the environment and migrant labor and corruption, all related to the Olympics, has been taken in some venues in Russia as proof of the West's perennial desire to hold Russia back, to keep Russia weak, to paint Russia as somehow the sick man of Europe again, and that they want to escape that image and show that they're modern, they're scientific, they're technological, they're proud, they're young, they're energetic. And we will see what this Olympics accomplishes.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Kyle, we haven't come to you in a while. We have about 30 seconds. Any thoughts on this eve of the Olympics?
Well, I hope everything goes well. It's coming right up. Like I said, I think the times are drastically different from when Russia sought this and it was awarded. And I think in some quarters there's almost the feeling of, you know, it's upon us. Let's get it over. Let's hope everyone stays safe and you know, has a little fun down there. But I would note that, again, the games are very much associated with the person of Vladimir Putin. It hasn't been something that Russian nationalists have really seized on and made their cause.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much. Laura Henry, Suzanne Massey, James Warhola, thank you all for being here. Laura Henry, the acting chair of the Russian Department at Bowdoin College. Suzanne Massey, a leading student of Russia and author of Trust But Verify, Reagan, Russia, and Me, just out. James Warhola, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Maine in Orono. And Kyle Parker, senior policy advisor for Russia at the U.S. Helsinki Commission and a native of Old Town and graduate of the University of Maine. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Our volunteer, Lucas Randall Owens, answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board, and we had additional help from Rich Tozier and Nick Godfrey in our Bangor studio, as well as the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. Our podcasts are also now available on iTunes.